A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's asking why the thing you grab when you can't breathe hasn't changed since he was a kid. Chronic asthma care has been through, what, 3 or 4 generations of inhalers in that time? But the rescue inhaler is still Ventolin, still albuterol, same blue canister. And he's got 2 real questions folded in there. 1, why do nebulizers still exist when a meter dose inhaler with a spacer does the same job? And 2, are we any closer to a rescue drug that doesn't leave you shaking like a wet dog?
The second question has a more interesting answer than most people expect, because the innovation isn't in making a smoother bronchodilator. It's in changing what rescue means.
Explain that.
Albuterol is a beta-2 agonist. It binds to receptors on airway smooth muscle and tells the muscle to relax, and it does that within minutes. That mechanism is fast, it's cheap, it's generic, and nothing has beaten it for pure speed of symptom relief. The reason chronic therapy evolved is that the target moved from bronchoconstriction to inflammation. Steroids, biologics, all of that addresses the underlying immune process. Rescue never moved because nobody was trying to make a better smooth muscle relaxer. They were trying to bolt inflammation control onto the rescue moment.
So the static Ventolin thing isn't a failure of pharmacology. It's that the drug was already very good at the one thing it does.
Right. And the thing it doesn't do is touch inflammation. That's the gap. GIANA, the Global Asthma Initiative, stopped recommending albuterol alone as the default reliever back in 2019 because overusing it's associated with worse outcomes. People who go through 3 or more canisters a year have roughly doubled the mortality risk and nearly doubled the exacerbation rate. That's not because the drug is toxic, it's because relying on it means you're not treating the inflammation that's driving the attacks.
So the danger isn't the puffs you take, it's the puffs you keep needing.
And that's the context for the thing that actually did change rescue. A couple of years ago, the FDA approved a combination inhaler called AirSupra. It's albuterol plus budesonide, which is an inhaled corticosteroid. Same fast bronchodilation, but every rescue use also delivers an anti-inflammatory dose.
So the rescue inhaler is now doing double duty. It's a reliever and a preventer in the same canister.
That's the bet. The trial data is strong. In mild asthmatics, as needed albuterol budesonide cut severe exacerbation risk by 46% compared to albuterol alone. Annualized severe exacerbations went from 0.32 per year down to 0.15. And systemic steroid exposure dropped by over 60%. That's prednisone courses avoided. That's meaningful.
But it doesn't solve the shaking.
No. It's still albuterol. The tremor, the jitteriness, the fast heart rate, those are intrinsic to beta-2 agonism. The drug is telling your sympathetic nervous system to wake up, and that wakes up everything, not just the airways. The valbuterol, the purified isomer version, was supposed to reduce that. It does, a bit. Heart rate rises a little lower. But the effect is modest, and it's not approved for kids under 6. And there's a small but consistent signal of more exacerbations in young children on it, which is the opposite of what you want.
So, the drug that was supposed to be gentler might be less effective in the population that needs gentlest.
That's the tension. And nothing in late-stage development replaces the beta-agonist mechanism for acute rescue. I looked. There's no novel bronchodilator about to show up. The innovation is stacking an inhaled steroid with the albuterol, not engineering away the tremor.
Which brings us to the nebulizer question. Because Daniel's instinct, there's the same instinct most patients have. The mask feels like more medicine.
And the evidence says it isn't. There's a systematic review from this year, 20 randomized trials, over 2,000 participants, acute asthma in emergency departments. No difference in hospital admission between metered dose inhaler with spacer and nebulizer? Not in adults, not in children, not in severe exacerbations. In kids, the spacer route was actually associated with shorter emergency department stays and fewer adverse events.
Fewer adverse events. So the nebulizer isn't just equal. It's slightly worse on tolerability.
In some of the data, yes. An earlier meta-analysis in children found the spacer route produced a smaller rise in heart rate, about 6.5 beats per minute less, and better pulmonary index scores. A Japanese study from last year found comparable clinical scores but significantly shorter length of stay with spacer, 61 minutes versus 94.
So why does the nebulizer still exist? If the evidence has been this clear for years, what's keeping it alive?
Practicality and perception. A nebulizer doesn't require coordination. You put the mask on and breathe. For a 2-year-old, for someone gasping too hard to time a puff, for someone who can't hold their breath, the nebulizer is just easier. It can run continuously with oxygen. Those are real advantages. But they're workflow advantages, not pharmacological ones. The perception gap is huge. A survey of patients and providers found 60% of patients believed nebulizers were more effective, and about half of doctors and nurses agreed. The trial evidence says the opposite.
So the machine has a placebo architecture. It hisses, it mists, it takes 10 minutes. It feels like medicine happening to you.
And there's a comfort factor. Patients who found the nebulizer more comfortable were dramatically more likely to prefer it. The odds ratio was something like 44. But one study from a community health center found that patients treated with spacer had 0 return visits within 30 days versus 61% of the nebulized patients. The spacer group did better and cost less.
That's a staggering number. 61% bounce back versus 0.
Small study, single site, so I'd hold it lightly. But the direction matches everything else. The spacer isn't just as good. It may be better, partly because it forces better technique, partly because you're not sitting in a clinic breathing aerosolized pathogens around the room. That was a real concern during COVID. Nebulizers aerosolize whatever's in your lungs.
So, the nebulizer survived because it's easier to use in a crisis, and because everyone involved believes it's stronger. The belief is the load-bearing wall.
And because hospitals already own them. The sunk cost is real. A nebulizer machine is a durable piece of equipment. A spacer is a plastic tube that costs a few dollars. The economics don't favor the hospital's balance sheet, even if they favor the patient.
Let me pull on the yellow zone thread, because that's where Daniel says he actually lives. Not the crisis, not the daily routine, but the cold triggered slide where things are worse but not urgent. Care worse.
The guidelines call that the yellow zone, and it's the least evidence-based part of asthma care. The American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology published a practice parameter on it, and the document itself admits the yellow zone is frequently poorly defined and that the standard recommendations don't work for everyone. That's the guideline saying we don't have this nailed down.
That's refreshingly honest for a guideline.
It is, and the practical recommendations are interesting. One is to activate the yellow zone plan at the first sign of an upper respiratory infection if that's a known trigger. Not wait until symptoms get bad. The data shows symptoms typically rise over about 5 days before they peak, so there's a window.
5 days. So by the time you feel properly bad, you're already most of the way up the curve.
And the window for intervention was a week ago. The other recommendation that's worth knowing is quadrupling the inhaled steroid dose for 7 days at the first sign of worsening, not doubling. The older guidance said doubling, and it didn't work. Quadrupling for a week seems to prevent some exacerbations that would otherwise require oral steroids.
Quadrupling? That's a lot of puffs.
It is, and it's a short burst, and it's not right for everyone. But the logic is that when a cold hits, the inflammation is ramping up, and you want to hit it hard before the airway remodels into a crisis. The other piece is symptom-driven dosing. Instead of a fixed steroid dose every day, you take extra steroid with your reliever when symptoms spike. That's basically what the AirSuper combination does automatically.
So the yellow zone gap that Daniel's describing, the not-quite-crisis, is being addressed in two ways. One is protocol, quadruple the steroid early. The other is product. Put the steroid in the rescue inhaler so you can't forget to take it.
And the product approach has better adherence built in. The problem with quadrupling is that patients don't do it. Fewer than a quarter of asthmatics even have a written action plan. So the guideline says quadruple your steroid, and the patient says, I don't have a written plan, I don't know what quadrupling means, I'll just take an extra puff of Ventolin and hope.
The AirSuper approach sneaks the steroid in. You're already reaching for the rescue inhaler because you feel bad. The steroid rides along.
That's exactly the design logic, and the trial data suggests it works. The Batura trial, published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, showed the combination cut severe exacerbations by 46% in mild asthmatics. The label got updated last September to cover all asthma severities in adults. AstraZeneca's stated goal is to make it the standard of care for rescue.
So the rescue inhaler of the future is a two-drug inhaler, and the single-drug albuterol becomes the dinosaur.
That's the marketing line, but it's not wrong. Albuterol only rescue treats the symptom. The combination treats the symptom and the process. The reason chronic care moved to steroids and biologics is that inflammation is the disease. Rescue is finally catching up to that insight.
But the jitteriness. Daniel's point stands. If you're in the gap, you don't want to choose between wheezing and vibrating.
And nobody has solved that. The beta agonist mechanism is the only fast bronchodilator we have. The tremor is the price of admission. Levalbuterol trims it slightly, but not enough to matter for most people, and the pediatric safety signal is a real concern. There's no non-beta agonist rescue drug in late-stage development that I can find. The innovation is in what you stack with the beta agonist, not in replacing it.
So, the honest answer to Daniel's question is, no, we're not close to a jitter-free rescue. We're close to a rescue that you need less often because it's treating the underlying problem.
And that might be the better outcome. If you have fewer exacerbations, you take fewer rescue doses, and the cumulative tremor burden drops. The side effect doesn't go away per puff, but the puffs go down.
Which is a strange kind of progress. The drug didn't get smoother. The disease got less sharp.
The other thing worth saying is that the tremor is dose-dependent and technique-dependent. If you're using a spacer properly, you get more drug to the lungs and less to the systemic circulation. That can reduce the systemic side effects somewhat. The spacer isn't just about delivery efficiency. It's about keeping the drug where it belongs.
So the spacer is doing two jobs. It's making the inhaler as effective as a nebulizer, and it might be trimming the jitters by keeping albuterol out of your bloodstream.
The heart rate data supports that. The spacer route showed a smaller heart rate rise than nebulizer in the pediatric analysis. Part of that's probably lower systemic absorption. The nebulizer aerosolizes the drug and you breathe it in over 10 minutes, but a lot of it lands in your mouth and throat and gets swallowed. The spacer gets a finer mist deeper into the lungs, so you need less total drug for the same effect.
So the mask isn't delivering more medicine, it's delivering less precisely.
That's the irony. The thing that feels like more medicine is actually less efficient. The spacer looks like a cheap plastic tube, but it's the precision instrument.
Daniel's had asthma since childhood. He's probably been handed a nebulizer mask in an emergency department at some point, and felt like he was getting the serious treatment.
And that's the perception gap in a nutshell. The nebulizer is theater as much as therapy. The hiss, the mist, the mask, the 10 minutes of sitting there. It feels like intensive care. The spacer is a tube you bought at a pharmacy. One of them looks like medicine, and the other looks like a toy.
The toy outperforms the machine.
In every endpoint that matters. Admission rates, length of stay, adverse events, cost. The nebulizer's only real wins are in patients who can't coordinate an inhaler, and in continuous oxygen delivery for very severe cases.
So if Daniel's ever in a position where someone's wheeling out the nebulizer, should he ask for the spacer instead?
If he can coordinate the inhaler, yes. The evidence supports it. But I'd phrase it as, the spacer is at least as good, and probably better, and it's faster. A lot of emergency departments have already switched protocols, especially after COVID. The nebulizer is fading in acute care, just slowly.
Because the belief is sticky. 60% of patients think the nebulizer is stronger. That's not a knowledge gap. That's a cultural fact.
And half of clinicians agree. So the patient asks for the nebulizer. The nurse thinks it'll help. The machine gets wheeled out. The evidence is fighting a lifetime of conditioning.
Let me ask you about the cold-triggered scenario specifically, because that's where Daniel says he lives. He gets a cold, his asthma gets worse, but not urgent, care worse. What should he actually do on day one of the cold?
Day one is the window. If colds are a known trigger, the guideline says activate the plan at the first sniffle, not when the wheeze starts. That means starting or increasing the inhaled steroid immediately. The quadrupling recommendation is 7 days at 4 times the usual dose. If he's on a combination inhaler for maintenance, he might already have a formoterol steroid combination that can be used as both maintenance and reliever. That's the Genotrac 1 approach, the MART strategy. You take extra puffs of the same inhaler when symptoms spike.
So the modern answer to the yellow zone is, your maintenance inhaler is also your rescue inhaler, just at a higher dose.
For many patients, yes. The formoterol in those combinations is a long-acting beta agonist, but it has a fast onset, so it works as a reliever. You get bronchodilation plus steroid with every extra puff. It's the same logic as Airsupra, just with a different steroid and a different beta agonist.
And the old model was, take your purple inhaler every morning, take your blue inhaler when you feel bad, and never the twain shall meet.
The old model trained patients to think of prevention and rescue as separate. The new model says they're the same process at different intensities. Inflammation flares, you hit it with steroid. Bronchoconstriction happens, you hit it with beta agonist. Both things are usually happening at once, so the inhaler should do both.
That's a different mental model. It's not just a new drug, it's a new story about what an asthma attack is.
And the story matters, because the old story led to albuterol overuse. Patients would puff the blue inhaler, feel better for an hour, puff again, and never treat the inflammation that was building. 3 canisters a year, double the mortality. The new story says, if you're reaching for the blue inhaler more than twice a week, your inflammation is uncontrolled, and the answer is more steroid, not more albuterol.
So the static Ventolin thing is partly a story problem. The drug didn't change because the story didn't change.
Until GINE changed the story in 2019, and the products are catching up. Airsupra is the first rescue inhaler with a steroid in it. The MART strategy makes the maintenance inhaler the rescue inhaler. Both are the same idea, stop treating the symptom and the disease as separate events.
What about the 12-puff threshold? I've seen that number in the guidelines.
The yellow zone parameter says if you're exceeding 12 puffs of albuterol in a day, contact a provider. That's the line where home management has failed and you need escalation. The problem is, most patients don't know that number. They'll puff through a whole canister over a weekend and show up Monday in worse shape.
12 puffs is a lot of puffs. If you're hitting that, you're already in trouble.
And the 5-day lead time means you probably should have escalated 4 days earlier. The symptoms rise over 5 days on average. By the time you're at 12 puffs a day, you're near the peak.
So the action plan isn't just a piece of paper. It's a timeline. Day 1, quadruple the steroid. Day 3, if you're still climbing, call someone. Day 5, if you're at 12 puffs, you're probably in an emergency department.
And the tragedy is that fewer than a quarter of patients have the plan at all, so the timeline is invisible.
Which is why the Airsupra approach is clever. You don't need a plan to take the steroid. It's in the same canister as the thing you're already reaching for.
Adherence by design. It's the same trick as putting fluoride in toothpaste. You don't have to remember to do the extra thing.
But it's still albuterol, so the shaking is still there.
Still there. And I want to be clear about this because Daniel asked directly. There's no non-beta agonist rescue bronchodilator coming. I searched the literature and the development pipelines. Nothing in late stage. The tremor is intrinsic to the mechanism that works. Levalbuterol is the only alternative, and it's a modest improvement at best, with real caveats in young children.
The honest answer to the jitteriness question is no.
The honest answer is no. But the total amount of jitteriness in your life might go down because you'll need fewer rescue doses. And if you use a spacer, you might get less systemic exposure per dose. But the drug itself still makes you shake. That's the deal.
Daniel said something interesting in the prompt. In a true emergency, he'd accept the fast heart rate and the shaking. It's the gap that bothers him. The cold triggered slide where he's not dying, but he's not fine.
That's exactly where the new combination inhalers help most. The yellow zone is where inflammation is building, but the crisis hasn't hit. A steroid in the rescue inhaler means every puff is also treating the process that's going to make tomorrow worse. The Batura data shows the exacerbation reduction is real. 46% fewer severe events. That's the gap closing.
The answer to Daniel's question is, yes, there's a better option for the gap, but it's not a smoother bronchodilator. It's a smarter one.
It's a rescue inhaler that treats the disease, not just the symptom. That's the shift. And it's the same shift that transformed chronic care 20 years ago, finally arriving at the rescue canister.
Which makes you wonder why it took so long. The steroid was always there. The albuterol was always there. Why did it take until 2023 to put them in the same canister?
Partly regulatory. Combination inhalers for maintenance had to be proven first. Partly habit. The blue inhaler was so culturally entrenched that nobody wanted to mess with it. Partly the belief that rescue should be simple, one drug, no confusion. And partly the fact that albuterol is so cheap and generic that there was no commercial pressure to innovate.
Until the mortality data on SABA overuse started piling up. That's the thing that broke the inertia.
The twofold mortality risk with three canisters a year. That's a number that gets attention. It reframed albuterol overuse from a bad habit to a survival issue. And that reframing is what opened the door for anti-inflammatory rescue.
The Ventolin era ended not with a better Ventolin, but with a different idea about what Ventolin is for.
The new idea is still rolling out. Adoption is uneven. A survey of Italian physicians found pulmonologists and allergists mostly favor the new approach, but general practitioners are split, 55%. The old model is sticky.
The general practitioner is the front line. If they're still writing albuterol, only scripts, the revolution hasn't landed.
The patient has to know to ask. Daniel's question suggests he's been on albuterol-only rescue his whole life. He might benefit from asking his doctor about a combination rescue inhaler, or about the MART strategy if he's on a maintenance combination already.
That's the practical takeaway. If you're in the yellow zone a lot, ask whether your rescue inhaler should have a steroid in it.
If you're using a nebulizer at home, ask whether a spacer would do the same job faster and cheaper. The evidence says yes.
The nebulizer thing is wild to me. 20 randomized trials, no difference in admission, and yet the machine persists.
The machine persists because it's easier in a crisis and because everyone believes in it. Belief is a powerful delivery mechanism.
The belief is the medicine.
In some cases, literally. The placebo effect of the nebulizer is probably real. You feel like you're getting intensive treatment, so you relax, and relaxation helps breathing. But the pharmacology isn't doing more work.
The nebulizer is a very expensive way to feel like you're being treated.
A very expensive, very wet way.
Daniel's other question was about the mask specifically. What does the mask do additionally or differently?
The mask just delivers the aerosol without requiring a seal around a mouthpiece. For a child or someone too breathless to hold a mouthpiece, the mask is easier. It doesn't change the dose, it changes the interface.
The mask is about compliance, not concentration.
The drug is the same drug, the dose is the same dose, the only difference is how it gets into the airway. And the spacer with a mouthpiece does it more efficiently.
I want to go back to the yellow zone for a second, because there's a number that stuck with me. 5.1 days from first symptom to peak.
That's the mean lead time. It varies a lot by patient and by trigger, but the point is that exacerbations don't usually come out of nowhere. They build.
The asthmatic has a 5-day warning system. And most of them don't know it exists.
Even if they do, the action plan is often too vague. The guideline admits the yellow zone is poorly defined. Take more of your steroid. How much more? When? For how long? The quadrupling recommendation is more specific, but it's buried in a practice parameter that most patients will never read.
The product approach, the air supra approach, sidesteps the vagueness. You don't need to know how much more. The canister does it for you.
That's the promise. And the trial data says it works. The question is whether real-world use matches the trials. That's always the question.
What about the systemic steroid exposure number? 62% less prednisone.
That's the annualized exposure in the BOTRA trial. 23 milligrams per year versus 62. That's not just a clinical endpoint, that's a quality of life endpoint. Prednisone is miserable. Weight gain, insomnia, mood swings, blood sugar spikes. If you can avoid even one course a year, that's a real win.
The combination inhaler isn't just preventing exacerbations. It's preventing the treatment for the exacerbations.
Which is often worse than the exacerbation itself. Ask anyone who's been on a prednisone burst. The rescue inhaler that prevents the prednisone is doing double duty.
Daniel's had asthma since childhood. He's probably had a few prednisone bursts. The moon face, the rage, the hunger.
The shaking from albuterol on top of it. The whole thing stacks.
The new rescue inhaler might not stop the shaking, but it might stop the thing that makes the shaking necessary.
That's the pitch. And for the yellow zone patient, that's probably the right trade. Fewer crises, less prednisone, even if each puff still makes you a little jittery.
Which is a strange place to land. The answer to the jitteriness question is no, but we've made the jitteriness less frequent.
Progress in asthma has always been about frequency. Fewer exacerbations, fewer hospitalizations, fewer steroid courses. The drugs themselves are still blunt instruments. We're just getting better at using them less.
The blunt instrument is still blunt. We've just put a better handle on it.
Put a steroid in the handle.
I want to make sure we've actually answered Daniel's questions. Nebulizers exist because they're easier in a crisis and because belief is sticky, not because they deliver more medicine. The evidence says spacer is equal or better. And we're not close to a jitter-free rescue, but we do have rescue inhalers that treat inflammation, which reduces how often you need rescue.
For the yellow zone specifically, the cold-triggered slide, the best options are either the combination rescue inhaler or the MART strategy with a maintenance combination plus early steroid escalation when the cold starts. Day 1, not day 3.
The 5-day window.
The 5-day window. If you wait until you feel bad, you've missed most of it.
I keep thinking about the 61% versus 0% bounce back number. Even if it's a small study, the direction is so consistent. The spacer isn't just as good. It might be the better tool, and the nebulizer is surviving on vibes.
Vibes and sunk cost. Hospitals own the machines. Patients expect the machines. The machine is part of the ritual of acute care.
The ritual is the thing that's hard to change. The evidence has been clear for years, and the machine is still there.
Because medicine is a human practice, not just a technical one. The nebulizer makes the patient feel treated. The spacer makes the patient feel like they're using a toy. And the patient's belief affects their breathing.
The nebulizer is a placebo with a compressor.
A placebo that aerosolizes pathogens, which is why COVID pushed a lot of departments away from it. That was the one thing that actually moved practice.
A global pandemic did what 20 randomized trials couldn't.
Sometimes the evidence needs a crisis.
I counted these once. Not the machines. The puffs.
What do you mean, counted the puffs?
I worked in a warehouse pharmacy in the late 2000s, filling mail-order asthma prescriptions. My job was to count the canisters going out to the same addresses. You'd see the same patient, same blue inhaler, every 20 days. Sometimes every 2 weeks. The computer flagged it, but the pharmacist would override it. Said the patient knew their own breathing.
3 canisters a year is the danger line. Every 2 weeks is more like 24 canisters a year.
I didn't know the number then. I just counted. There was a woman in Ohio, same address for 3 years, never ordered anything but albuterol. No steroid, no combination, just the blue canister. Every 14 days, like clockwork. I used to wonder if she was breathing through the thing, or just collecting them.
And nobody called her.
The pharmacist said it wasn't his job to practice medicine through the mail. He was right, but the system was wrong. The computer flagged it, and the human overrode it. That was the whole story.
That's the overuse pattern the mortality data eventually caught up with. The woman in Ohio was the statistic before anyone had calculated it.
The other thing I noticed was the nebulizer solution. Same patients would order the albuterol solution for a home nebulizer, and the canisters, and sometimes both, in the same month. The machine and the inhaler, side by side. Nobody told them they were doing the same job.
The belief gap in real time.
I counted the orders for 2 years. The spacer orders were maybe 1 in 50. Everyone wanted the machine. The machine was what the hospital used, so the machine was what they wanted at home.
The spacer costs a few dollars. The machine is a few hundred. The economics push the wrong direction.
The warehouse made more on the nebulizer solution than the spacers. I don't think anyone was deliberately steering people, but the incentives weren't pointing toward the cheap plastic tube.
The system was built to deliver the expensive, less efficient thing.
The system was built to deliver what people ordered, and people ordered what they believed in. The belief came from the hospital. The machine came from the belief. The warehouse just counted.
That's the perception gap in a supply chain. 60% of patients believe the nebulizer is stronger, so they order the nebulizer solution, so the warehouse stocks more nebulizer solution, so the cycle reinforces itself.
I left that job in 2008. I still have a spacer in a drawer somewhere, never used it, just kept it.
A souvenir.
A reminder that the cheap thing was the right thing, and nobody believed it.
The spacer in the drawer is the whole episode.
It really is. The evidence was there, the cheap plastic tube was there, and the system kept shipping the expensive machine because the belief was stronger than the data.
The belief is still there. The spacer is still the underdog. But the new combination inhalers might finally change the story, because they make the rescue inhaler do more than rescue. They make it treat the disease.
The future of rescue isn't a smooth orbuterol. It's an orbuterol that you need less often, because it's also doing the prevention work.
That's the honest answer to Daniel. The shaking isn't going away. But the number of days you spend shaking might.
That's a strange kind of progress. Not a better drug, a better strategy.
Which is how asthma care has always moved. The drugs are blunt. The strategy gets sharper.
I keep thinking about the 5-day window. 5 days from first symptom to peak. That's the thing I want every asthmatic to know. The crisis doesn't come out of nowhere. It builds. And you can see it building. And the whole game is whether you act on day one or day four.
Whether you have a plan that tells you what to do on day one. The quadrupling, the extra puffs, the early call to the doctor. Most patients don't have the plan, so they wait, and the waiting is the danger.
The action plan isn't paperwork. It's a timing device.
It's a calendar for a process that's already running. The inflammation is on a schedule. The plan is how you get ahead of it.
The new inhalers are the plan, built into the device.
That's the hope. We'll see if it holds in the real world.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
If you've got a question like Daniel's, something you've wondered about for years and never got a straight answer, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.